Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Carlos K. Hill, author of the book, The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. Carlos, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yes, I am associate professor and chair of the Clara Luper Department of African and African American Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My area of expertise is the history of lynching and racial violence, with an emphasis on the anti-lynching movement. And, beyond sort of, the scholarly work that I do, I do a lot of work in the community, particularly to try to advance social justice issues, within Oklahoma, especially within Tulsa, Oklahoma City. So a lot of the work that I have done in those communities is reflected in the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History.
What inspired you to produce a photographic history of the race massacre in particular?
You know, I'm not from Oklahoma, only came to Oklahoma in the fall of 2016 to take a job at the University of Oklahoma. But shortly after arriving here, I made a trip to Tulsa. And it was a kind of a transformative trip because I heard Tiffany Crutcher speak, who spoke eloquently about Terrence Crutcher, her brother, who was shot and killed by a police officer in Tulsa. Tiffany has since then become one of the foremost and fiercest sort of advocates for defunding the police, as well as sort of, transformative institutional change in terms of policing. And so I was inspired by her witness to know more about Tulsa. But ultimately, I think it was my interactions with some of the key stakeholders in Tulsa around the history of the race massacre. Listening to them tell stories about what occurred, listening to members of the community that I came in contact with talk about the history, as well as just walking around the Greenwood District, where you see murals and memorials to this history. I just was inspired by what I was seeing and what I was hearing beginning in 2016 and into 2017. And so by the summer of 2017, I had kind of decided that I was going to write a book on the race massacre. I didn't know what it would look like. I didn't know how I was going to actually accomplish it by the centennial. But I was certainly inspired by the community to do so.
It's a very interesting book, and it's one that I want to get into more detail about. But before we do, I was wondering if you could give us a brief overview of the Tulsa Race Massacre, how it began, what happened during those 2 days, and then a bit about the aftermath. So give us a frame of reference before we delve into the photos themselves.
Yes. So the Tulsa Race Massacre, I believe, is the deadliest outbreak of anti-Black violence in American history. And I would say the the deadliest single sort of instance slash outbreak of anti-Black violence in American history that resulted in a 35-block area being completely destroyed, over 200 businesses wiped away, over 1,200 homes burned to the ground, and nearly, we believe, 300 people killed as a result of the violence. And so, you know, on May 31st and June 1st is when the violence and destruction occurred to the community. That violence was sparked, that violence was provoked by an allegation that a Black young man, Dick Rowland, had sexually assaulted in an elevator in downtown Tulsa a white girl, Sarah Page, who was, I believe, 17 years of age. And so the allegation that Sarah Page had been raped by a Black man, a Black young Black man, Dick Rowland, is what sparked the violence. But I would say that the real reasons for why the massacre occurred and why it escalated was because of the deep resentment that whites had or held toward the Greenwood District, or, you know, more affectionately known as Black Wall Street. And so, you know, the provocation was the allegation of rape or assault. But the deep causes for what occurred was the resentment that whites had toward Greenwood slash Black Wall Street. And so in the book, I try to tell that story. I try to say very clearly in the book that the massacre is an extremely important moment in the history of the Greenwood community. But for Greenwood residents, telling the story of the massacre is not representative of who they are as a community. And what they're typically suggesting or getting at is, in the aftermath of the deadliest outbreak of anti-Black violence in American history, the community rebuilt itself. If you fast forward 20 years after the race massacre, Greenwood was larger, had more people, wealthier, had more businesses. And, you know, the community experienced, beginning in the 1940s all the way to the 1960s, a renaissance. And so the story of rebuilding, the story of the renaissance, is the story that the community often likes to tell, because in telling that story, you get to understand the courage, the grit, the resilience, the quality of the people who called Greenwood home. And so for my book, it was really important for me not to just tell the story of the massacre, but to tell the story of how Black people in Tulsa responded to what occurred to them. And so I tried to do that as skillfully, as carefully as I could, because more than anything, I wanted this book to not just reflect my interpretation as a historian, but I also wanted to mirror the ways in which the community tells the story, understands the story of what occurred to them.
You tell the story in a variety of ways in your book. You summarize the history of the race massacre. You have a lot of excerpts from the testimony of survivors, both contemporary accounts and oral histories that were taken in the 1990s. But you also have this very fascinating examination of why we have this visual record. And I was wondering if you could perhaps explain why it is we have so many photographs of this crime, how it was that these photographs survived to the present day. And also the part of the story you get that I thought was most fascinating, the hints that we have that there's this even greater photographic record that might still be out there that for for whatever reason, we still don't have access to.
Yes. So when I think about the Tulsa Race Massacre, and particularly the photographic legacy, when I think about it, I frame it around and in relationship to the history of lynching and lynching culture. Lynching culture was a lot of different things, but a big part of it was photographs, lynching photographs, photographs taken of lynch victims and the mob who killed them. And so lynching photographs in many ways, particularly in the 19-teens and 20s, is a staple, is a core part of lynching culture. And, you know, the reason why whites took photographs of Black lynch victims or lynched Black bodies was to project white supremacy, was to inscribe themselves as defenders of the community, defenders of white womanhood, to capture the ways in which the best citizens, right, of the city or of the town had come together to punish, to expel a dangerous Black person. These were things that whites were proud of and that whites wanted to, in fact, brag about through taking photographs of, you know, Black people who they had killed, who they had reasserted control over. And so lynching culture was about terrorism. It was about, you know, punishing Black bodies. But at the end of the day, it was about projecting white supremacy and allowing whites opportunities, creating opportunities for whites to document their, you know, their participation in this culture, but also to inscribe themselves in this culture in ways that were very visual and very compelling. And so this is why, you know, there are, you know, there were hundreds of photographs of lynchings taken during the lynching era, which, you know, is about 1880 to 1930, although some would say it stretches into the 1950s. But Tulsa, you know, and the Tulsa Race Massacre falls squarely within the era of lynching. And certainly, you know, the photograph and the photographs and the photographic legacy left behind by the massacre is in line with lynching culture. And so I was, you know, my background as a historian of lynching was really helpful and trying to make sense of these photographs, because otherwise it would appear strange that, you know, whites would, you know, take pictures that document, you know, their participation in criminality, right? Burning and looting and killing, destruction of property. It would be mind blowing, for why would someone incriminate themselves? We have to step back and think about the ways in which whites understood photography as a way to valorize the violence, celebrate the violence, and in a very insidious ways, perpetuate that violence through photography.
I think that comes across very well in your in how you use the captions to describe what's happening in certain photos. Things that, if you study it for a long period of time, you might pick up on, but you make it very clear. Once you make it clear, it seems so obvious about how, in so many of these photos, you have there's a very conscious pose by, say, the armed posse members or the National Guardsmen, who are brandishing weapons, oftentimes, a group of Black people in view, you know, one armed white man with a shotgun, you know, towering over a group of you know, basically prisoners, and how that, you know, it underscores the degree to which, you know, the power is being projected through that image.
Yeah, I mean, The photographs in the book are some of the most compelling images that I reviewed as I sort of, studied the more than 500 images that I was able to access through the Tulsa Historical Society, the University of Tulsa, and the Oklahoma Historical Society. There were probably six or seven other archives that I consulted and gleaned some images from, but the majority come from those three places. And my challenge was to try to not just, find or identify the most compelling images that help people to understand the white supremacy that produced the race massacre, but also images that would help us to understand the Black experience of what occurred. And so I was trying to select photographs that could do both, but ultimately my goal for the book was to center the perspectives of victim survivors and their descendants, try to tell the story as powerfully as possible through photographs that would then help explain, what occurred to Black people who were killed during the race massacre, but also were fortunate enough to survive the race massacre. And so the photographs are a challenge to do that because most of the photographs created, during this time were by whites. And in those photographs, because of that, carry with it the kind of white gaze, what white spectators, what white mob participants wanted us to understand about the race massacre, not, the perspective of Black Americans who suffered from it. And so it was a challenge to try to walk that line. But I think because of the selection of oral history testimony that's provided, that really makes clear and really makes, in some really visceral ways, what they experienced as a result of the violence. I think there's a way in which, at least partially, the white supremacist narrative that the photographs were meant to provide is disrupted, and the accounts of survivors just briefly, just temporarily disrupts that white supremacist gaze. And allows us to see the images from the vantage point of victims and survivors. And so the reason why so many, quotes from survivors were included is because I really wanted the testimony to really allow readers to reinterpret and reposition the photographs in ways that told the story from the vantage point of survivors.
I like another of the methods that you use to do that, which is by starting not with the massacre itself, but giving your readers an opportunity to see the Greenwood District as it was prior to May 31st, 1921. And the photos that you have there are, I just find to be really fascinating because they convey something of that. Prosperity and pride. I'm thinking in particular of the photo you have of John Wesley Williams and his wife when they're sitting in their car. And to know that, back then car ownership wasn't quite as widespread as it would become even by even a decade later. And yet to see someone, proudly dressed nicely, sitting in his car with his family, it really does convey something of that sense of what had been accomplished in the community by the people who lived in it.
Absolutely. One of my frustrations in doing a photographic history is of the race massacres. There are so few photographs of what Greenwood looked like prior to the events of May 31st and June 1st, 1921. There's just a handful of high quality images that could be reproduced for a book. And so I was frustrated by that, particularly because there's so many images of the destruction. And so, I really wanted to devote a whole chapter to that, but I didn't want it to just be images of Greenwood residents. I wanted to actually show what the community looked like, what it would have maybe even felt like to traverse Greenwood or even Greenwood Avenue, prior to 1921. But I wasn't able to do that, and so I included the small number of images because at the end of the day, I wanted people to understand that the story of Greenwood doesn't begin and end with the race massacre. In roughly a decade, or let's say, maybe 15 years, the Greenwood district becomes one of the wealthiest Black communities in the country, not the largest, but one of the wealthiest in the country. And this is this occurred because of the quality of the Black people that migrated to Oklahoma and then ultimately to Tulsa. And so by including an image of the Williams family, as well as the Dreamland Theater, I was trying to give readers a taste of the quality of the caliber of people who called Greenwood home, the caliber of people who were killed in the violence, the caliber of people who ended up rebuilding Greenwood, despite the fact that they had no assurances that the violence or a mob attack would ever occur again. For me, it was very, very important to make sure that, people understood that there was something there was a community there before, a vibrant community there before that was destroyed, but then ultimately rebuilt.
And that chapter then is immediately followed by the one detailing the massacre itself. And you begin with some testimonies, and then gradually you insert the images. I was wondering if there was an image or two in that chapter that that you found particularly powerful or particularly symbolic of what you what was happening during the massacre, and which you think really conveys the message, especially the message you're trying to convey with the book.
Yes. On page, I believe, 59, there's an image of a postcard, in fact, the caption reads, "Running the Negro out of town or out of Tulsa." Of all the images that I reviewed and ultimately utilized in the book, that one is the one that speaks to me the most, because what I discovered in talking with residents, descendants in particular, but also in just sort of reading all the historical accounts and especially survivor accounts, what became clear to me that anchored in that photograph, what became clear to me is that this wasn't just a violent attack on a prosperous community that resulted in a 35 block area being destroyed. What began to dawn on me is that this was an attempted expulsion of Black people from Tulsa. And when you think about the context, it makes sense, because next door to Oklahoma is Arkansas, where several Black communities during the 1890s as well as the first decade of the 20th century, were violently expelled from those communities. It occurred also in Missouri. And so Oklahoma's next door neighbors had a history of violently expelling Black communities after an allegation of murdering a white person or a sexual assault of a white woman. And so, you know, it was, quote unquote, in the water in this region. This is how you respond to, Black criminality. And so it became clear to me with that photograph that this is much more than a race massacre. This is more or less a community lynching, right? And when I say that in the epilogue, what I'm trying to get people to understand is that the purpose of the violence was ultimately about driving away Black people, forcing Black people, this community of nearly 11,000, out of Tulsa. And so for me, that's what makes the violence unprecedented, because you can kind of, carefully review the record of anti-Black violence in this country, and you'd be hard pressed to find a similar instance with a similar size community, similar kind of affluence, that whites, particularly a white mob, attempts to expel from its community. And so for me, for all those reasons, that photograph really tells the story of what actually happened. But fortunately, the survivors of the race massacre believe that their community was worth fighting for, was worth preserving, and no intimidation, no violence was going to change that. And so for me, chapters 5 and 6 in the photographic history are the most important chapters, because it embodies, for me, the story that victim survivors and descendants have wanted to tell about what occurred.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I was, that photo I shared was very striking, but I didn't really make this connection until you were describing it and I looked it up. But I remember when I first saw it, it looked familiar and I couldn't figure out why. And I realized it is so evocative of what the images you would see a decade later for the Dust Bowl. And I was thinking about that. What things that makes that photo so powerful is it is one of the ones that best conveys the scale of what's happening. It's not the only one that you have of Greenwood burning, but it's one of the ones, it's almost panoramic in terms of its scope. You have this wide back shot. You could see some people on the road looking at it, but you have this just over half the image is just these billowing clouds of smoke that are coming up that are like the dust clouds. It gives a sense that we're not just talking about one building or one house or one street. We're talking about the entire neighborhood. And you see it not just in terms of the buildings that are burning, but how it's just, clogging the sky with what's taking place. And yet, as you then go on to do in the second chapter, is you show what happened to the people who weren't killed. And this is part of the story that is not as familiar to people who might have a passing knowledge of it, which is how the people that weren't killed were then rounded up and interned by the authorities, by not just the police or the National Guard, but by people that they had deputized to, and how they had to then go and effectively find someone to testify for them, not, you know, a black person, but of course a white person, to, in order to, you know, be allowed to have their freedom.
Yeah. I mean, the story of the massacre is so much more than the burning, the looting, and even the killing. It is much deeper. And it's much more, I think, treacherous. And I would even say, from the vantage point of victims, or excuse me, from survivors, a deeply humiliating experience, because as their homes are being burned down, destroyed, as their businesses are, they're also being stripped, effectively stripped of their civil rights. They are, you know, being rounded up. Whites are, you know, are the white mob, white authorities are moving house to house. Forcibly removing in many cases black people from their homes. Most black people have barricaded themselves in their home. They're afraid to come out because if they come out, they could be shot and killed. They could be hit by a stray bullet that wasn't meant for them, because there is, you know, active machine gun fire. There are, you know, projectiles, you know, some have argued bombs that are being dropped on the community. And so this is a chaotic and dangerous moment. And so black people, I think, wisely were remaining in their homes and even fighting back from their homes and businesses. But ultimately, because, you know, and I tried to really emphasize this point in the introduction, because the invasion or the attack on the community was coordinated, and it was, not only was it coordinated, I talk about it as a kind of intentional military style assault. Many in the community stayed within their homes until they absolutely had to come out, until they were absolutely forced to surrender. And upon surrendering, everyone, whether they were a man, a woman, or a child, was detained. They were taken to they were forced to show that they had no weapons and then forced to hold their hands above their heads for the duration of their trip from their home to the detention center to show to whites that they posed no threat. And of course, as this is happening, as they are being sort of paraded through the streets of Tulsa as kind of this defeated group, whites, even white children, are jeering at them, or yelling at them, screaming obscenities at them. And this experience, coupled with the, you know, watching their homes, their businesses be destroyed, watching loved ones being killed in front of them, this totality of the experience is what makes the race massacre such a wounding experience. And so when I think about what all survivors had to go through, what they would have had to sort of process and endure, in the aftermath, and how, if it were me, I don't think I would have had the resolve or the strength to turn the other cheek and roll up my sleeves and get to work rebuilding a community that had just been destroyed. And so the story of courage and resilience is so remarkable. And for me, that is what really has inspired me to do this work. And I think will inspire me to continue to write about, talk about the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre well beyond you know, the centennial.
It roughly half the book, talks about that aftermath. And one of the things that also was a revelation for me was the role of the Red Cross in this effort. I was thinking as I was looking at the pages and the description that you have of the activities, how much it was like disaster management, how there was this short-term need to feed refugees, to provide for them, to give them housing, and then how you arrange the photographs in a way to show how from that initial effort began the reconstruction process, began the process of rebuilding the community, converting the tents into temporary homes, and then going from there to begin the process of putting the community back together.
Yeah, I mean, there wouldn't be a Greenwood without the American Red Cross, I believe. Black people Black survivors would have just simply had very little support to not only rebuild, but just to, you know, have medical attention, to have food, to have some basic shelter. Without the American Red Cross, the humanitarian assistance, the humanitarian efforts would have been stalled, would have maybe never even happened. Because, you know, the city, while it proclaimed to the world the days after the race massacre that it would provide assistance to survivors, it would help the community rebuild. It became clear in the days following that wasn't going to happen. The energy that the city is expending is around, putting up barriers to the community rebuilding, not helping the community to rebuild. And so the American Red Cross was able to kind of cut through some of that and provide the much needed food, medicine, shelter, for the victims, of the worst race massacre in American history. And so, because of that, you know, these survivors talk about, the American Red Cross as the angels of mercy or as angels of mercy, because without them, it would have been extremely difficult given the level of hostility that existed at the moment in the white community towards Greenwood. It would have been extremely difficult to rely on, city leadership or even philanthropic groups within Tulsa to do the same. And so, you know, I think the moniker Angels of Mercy is a well-deserved one for the American Red Cross and how they responded.
I think one of my favorite pictures in your fourth chapter is the one on page 187, where you have Buck Colbert Franklin and Isaiah Spears, the two attorneys who are reestablishing their law office in a tent, and you have their secretary between them. And I find it just such a great picture in a lot of ways, because not only do you have that, you know, that sense of it, of how they're picking up, they're getting started, but as you explain in the caption, that this was an example of how the residents of Greenwood fought back. You described how there were efforts to put building codes in place that would have made rebuilding prohibitively difficult. They fought back against that. They fought back to sue the city of Tulsa to receive some sort of compensation. And it's that one picture, I think, is so nicely encapsulated in a way by showing how these three people as individuals are picking up and, you know, using the tools of their community, the laws of their state, to try to reclaim what they had lost.
Yeah, I mean, the Greenwood, the Greenwood district, as I mentioned, wouldn't have survived the race massacre without the assistance of the American Red Cross. But it wouldn't have also survived without the efforts of Black leaders within the community fighting on legal grounds for, you know, for the community. And so the city, the mayor of Tulsa, along with some very prominent business leaders, desired to convert the business district or the first two blocks and then the area surrounding them into a train depot or an industrial depot. You know, Greenwood was situated in a really strategic area. It was between downtown and the railroads. And so for white city leaders, the Greenwood district and its business district was in the way. Tulsa had grown since the founding of Greenwood. Tulsa had discovered oil since the founding of Greenwood, or the area around Tulsa had discovered oil. And therefore those, you know, the community was in this area of prime real estate. And so the mayor, as well as some of the business leaders, saw in the massacre, the complete destruction of this community, an opportunity to rezone the area, but in rezoning the area, push the Black community out of Tulsa, or at minimum, to push it more north. And so without the work of B.C. Franklin, Buck Colbert Franklin, who was a lawyer, who was the father of John Hope Franklin, who become, you know, the quote unquote father of African-American history. Without Buck Colbert Franklin and his legal work to initially get the fire ordinance, as it was called, temporarily, a temporary injunction upon it on technicalities, but then ultimately to get it invalidated because it was, you know, the district judges, the three district judges who decided it, believed that it was unconstitutional for the city to impose such a an ordinance given the circumstances. That saved the Greenwood district. And so I would say the 1-2 punch of saving the Greenwood district was the American Red Cross. And if they, without them, Black people would have been forced to go elsewhere to find the support that they needed. But luckily and fortunately for them, the Tulsa-based American Red Cross, as well as the national organization, because it took the support from the national organization because the needs were so great in the community. Without them, community wouldn't have been able to rebuild, and certainly without the leadership of Blacks like Buck Colbert Franklin and others, you know, seeking to invalidate the fire ordinance, the community wouldn't have been able to rebuild.
One of the things you do in the book that I think does a nice job of conveying the process of Reconstruction is you have photos of certain key buildings. And I'm thinking, for example, of the Williams Dreamland Theater or the Baptist Church. And you were able to find photos of what they look like beforehand. You have photos of what happened to them during the race massacre. But then you also, in that final section, have photos of the Reconstruction process. And it's fascinating to see these and kind of is because that it's a great visual timeline of that process of achievement, destruction, rebuilding, and how by the time you get to the end of that chapter, you see the Greenwood Street again with all the buildings up again and that process of recovery well underway.
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable how quickly Greenwood residents were able to begin to rebuild. I mean, you know, days following the massacre, Black people, Black, you know, survivors are building temporary structures, putting up tents on the sites where their homes used to be. Same with businesses. So that a year after the race massacre, the Dreamland Theater is nearly, I believe, fully rebuilt. Several businesses in the kind of what we call Deep Greenwood, the first couple blocks of the community, had been rebuilt. And so, you know, and also homes were temporary structures, were transitioning, you know, a year later from those temporary structures to actual homes. And so for me, it's truly inspiring to see just the kind of tenacity, in the face of white intransigence, that Greenwood residents, displayed. It's not uncommon in the Black experience, but when you see it up close, when you study it up close, when you get to know, intimately some of the individuals, that responded in that way, you can't help but to be inspired. And so, you know, I think often, particularly when I'm tired, particularly when I don't want to do something that I should do, I often reflect on survivors and what they endured to sort of encourage me to move forward. So I think there's a lot to take from this history than just the knowledge of what occurred. There's so much that we can learn from the individuals who died as a result of the violence, but also those who survived and then responded to the violence and the destruction thereafter. And so for me, that's, I think this book emerged from the inspiration that I have continually experienced as I sort of reflect on, you know, survivors and how they responded.
I think you do a really nice job of conveying that in the final chapter, where you have the pictures of the survivors that were taken, you know, decades later, the pictures that were taken in the 1990s, early 2000s. And it really does, you know, and the way you couple that with excerpts from their testimonies, it really does underscore that point that you're making about the, you know, importance of the survivors and how they persevered through it, without never forgetting what they went through.
Yeah, for me, it's the reason why the images are so important, and they are also, and I don't really speak to this so much. I may have a passing mention of it, but the smiles of survivors, you know, those individuals had loved ones that were killed. They were nearly killed. They witnessed their beloved Black Wall Street destroyed. They participated in its rebuilding. They saw its reemergence as a community, and they were a staple part of that. And so for me, you know, it was important not just to share photographs of them, but to share a photograph of them smiling. And to show how those individuals, despite what happened to them, lived these lives of resilience, lived these lives of great substance, and the smiles help capture that, you know. And so the book, in many ways, is devoted to victim survivors and their descendants, but especially the survivors who had to endure the aftermath of the deadliest race massacre in American history.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, I have too many projects. too many. I'm overwhelmed by the work that I need to do in the next 2 to 3 years. But as much as I am committed to telling the story of the race massacre, for the race massacre, I'm working on a white eyewitness account of what occurred. We wanted to perhaps have that ready for the centennial, but it's just too much work to do to get that ready for publication. And so that'll come, you know, in maybe a 2 or 3 years, you know, from now. But what's on my heart, and you know, what I think about daily, is the story of Clara Looper in the 1958 Oklahoma City sit-ins. I'm contracted with the University of Oklahoma Press to create a new edition of Clara Looper's account of the 1958 sit-ins, you know, Behold the Walls. And so I'm really excited about getting that book out to the public by the 100th, by Clara Luper's 100th birthday, which is June of 2023. And so that's the my, you know, I would say most important project at the moment, and looking forward to sharing that and maybe coming back and talking about that with you in a couple years.
I'd love to have you back in a couple years to talk about the book.
It sounds great.
Oh, Carlos Hill, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Mark.